Well, my dearly beloved brothers and sisters, we left David last time in that situation where he no longer had the ecclesia. He no longer had Samuel, and he no longer has Jonathan. And it's within that context that we find David alone. And the record presents to us now trial after trial, after trial, after trial, without any let up. It seems these trials come one after the other after the other. And we're being told, of course, that God was going to prepare David through these trials for that work that he had for him to do. And so one trial after the other was going to be packed into this period of time so that David might learn all the lessons. And as we're going to see, sometimes it took one, two, or even three occasions before David learned the lesson. And perhaps we wish it could be that quick for us too. We remember the Lord Jesus, how, having heard of the death of John the Baptist, all he wanted to do was get away into a quiet place to be alone. And the people thronged around him, and he had compassion on them because they were as sheep without a shepherd. And so our Lord knew exactly what we will find David doing in this study. Saul, we know, had sought to kill David. He had been egged on, no doubt, by Abner. He was determined to hold on to the kingdom and to his position and his power. He knew that his kingdom would not continue. And we know, of course, that he was told this. Your kingdom, he's told, will not continue. In fact, he's told that it's going to be given to someone better than you, Saul. And if anything would hurt Saul's pride, an expression like that would. And Saul would be thinking, better than me. In fact, of course, he was told that it would be given to a neighbor. And Benjamin and Judah were neighboring tribes. It still took Saul a lot longer than Jonathan to recognize David. And we know, of course, that the one who was to anoint David, this successor to Saul, was already in danger of his life back in 1 Samuel 16. And this intent, this murderous intent of Saul, was to continue throughout this period until David fled into Philistine lands. And perhaps we'll just look at two of these. In 1 Samuel 18, we go back again and again to this chapter, do we not? And here is that expression that is picked up in the scripture. All day, every day. 1 Samuel 18 and verse 29. Where we read that Saul was yet the more afraid of David, and Saul became David's enemy continually. All day, every day. And we can find that some can be consumed by an issue, and it dominates them. And that's all they can think about all day, every day. If we turn to chapter 23, well into these trials that are coming upon David, we find the same expression again. 1 Samuel 23 and verse 14. David abode in the wilderness, in strongholds, and remained in a mountain in the wilderness of Ziph. And Saul sought him every day. And that term is the same. All day, every day. Saul's passion was to destroy this brother. And David was to describe the likes of Saul in the Proverbs. Just turn, if you would, to Proverbs 6, because there we find this record of the different attributes that David describes of those who are enemies of the truth. And so Saul had become David's enemy, but he had really become the enemy of the truth because he was in a snare that needed him to be taken out of. And Proverbs 6, we read in verse 16. These six things doth Yahweh hate, yea, seven are an abomination unto him: a proud look, a lying tongue, hands that shed innocent blood, and heart that deviseth wicked imaginations, feet that be swift in running to mischief, a false witness that speaketh lies, and he that soweth discord among brethren. We're not going to be like Saul was to David. But do we ever have a proud look when we compare ourselves to a brother or sister? Do we ever have a lying tongue when we want to appear better than someone else? Do we have hands that work to the downfall of someone who is innocent? Do we have a heart that is ready to work in a way that will destroy someone or make us better by their downfall? Do we have feet that are ready to go and work in a way and walk in a way that is inappropriate? Do we have a false witness against someone? Because if we do, then that means we're sowing discord among brethren. And that's the seventh, the worst. And David, no doubt, in his mind was thinking of Saul and others like him in those seven attributes that God hates. And that indeed is a strong word. And if any of those seven apply to us, then we need to beware. Causing discord. We won't turn there, but Proverbs 10 verse 12 says that hatred stirreth up strifes, but love covereth all sins. And so David is going to present to us in the record, God even is going to present to us at times, that in every trial there is going to be opportunity. And each trial will present its different opportunity. But what we do when that opportunity comes is not so black and white as we might think. And so, turning back to the record in 1 Samuel, this time to chapter 20, we find this hatred of Saul's has caused David to flee. And now David is to be labeled by Saul. He's got a mark on him. You know, so often we can place a mark on an ecclesia or a person. Well, I've heard of so-and-so, don't want to go there. I've heard of that ecclesia. Well, I've never been there myself, but it's dodgy. Make a little mark, mental note, perhaps even a mark in your ALS diary. And we can do the same. And 1 Samuel 20, we read in verse 31. For as long, says Saul, as the son of Jesse, do you see, he can't even say his name. As long as the son of Jesse liveth upon the ground, thou shalt not be established, Jonathan, nor thy kingdom. Wherefore now send and fetch him unto me, for he shall surely die. And as you see in the margin, he shall surely die. He's a son of death. And so Saul says, this man is one that is a son of death. He has got a mark upon him, a label. And interestingly, of course, that term was used of David himself. When Nathan came to him after the incident of Uriah and Bathsheba. And David says, that man's worthy of death. And he says, yep, you're a son of death, David. And this time he deserved it. Well, the record in 1 Samuel 21 shows us that he has nowhere to go. He can't go to Samuel. He can't go to Jonathan. He can't go home to Bethlehem. So 1 Samuel 21 verse 1. David came to Nob to Ahimelech the priest. And Ahimelech was afraid at the meeting of David and said unto him, why art thou alone and no man with thee? And again verse 6. So the priest gave him hallowed bread, for there was no bread there but the showbread that was taken from before Yahweh. He put hot bread in the day when it was taken away. And so David comes firstly to the priests. An interesting place to first visit. He is hungry. He has some men with him. We don't know the number. Perhaps they equated to the number of cakes that he took for him and his men. And he goes to this place. What's he doing there? What does he see there? What does he take? Well, we know, of course, the record. He takes the bread and he takes a sword. The sword of Goliath. Now, back in 1 Samuel 17, we know, of course, that after the slaying of Goliath, he had given courage to the men of Israel, and they routed the Philistines all the way to Ekron. And then it says that they returned to the tents of the Philistines to take away the things from there. So they returned to the Valley of Elah. Where do they go next? Well, we believe that there was a procession back to Gibeah. And David, carrying the head of the Philistine in his hand, he walks along and he takes that to Jerusalem. But we believe also that he was carrying in his other hand the sword of Goliath. And that procession continued, this time to Nob. And he deposited the sword of Goliath in the tabernacle, or as it says in 1 Samuel 17, in his tent. And the word tent is the same word as tabernacle. And then finally that procession made its way to Gibeah. And so David goes. He wants the bread. He wants that sword. But there was one more thing that he did while he was in Gibeah. Because verse 6 says to us that there was just the showbread that was before Yahweh, and David takes it away. But of course we know from the Lord Jesus Christ in the Gospels that Jesus says that he went into the tabernacle. And we know, of course, that when Doeg, the Edomite, saw David, he said to Saul, well, he inquired of Yahweh. We believe that what Doeg saw was David step inside the tabernacle with Ahimelech the priest. And he said, well, he must have gone in there to ask of God, to offer a prayer or something. And of course, what was inside that tabernacle? Well, of course, the ark wasn't in there. But we know that the inside curtains were. The lamp was burning. And on those curtains, and here is Brother Thomas's translation from verse 6, the bread of the faces taken from before the faces of Yahweh. And he explains the faces were the faces of the cherubim over against the table, embroidered onto the curtain of the tabernacle. They symbolize the spirit in flesh manifestation and were therefore the faces of the spirit. And so David goes, he takes hallowed bread. He sees the spirit manifest before his own eyes, and he takes the sword that he was allowed to cut off, the neck of the flesh. Brother Jim has not yet got to his disembodied head, but we have. And we had our patient as well yesterday in need of some medical aid. So here is David. It's a trial for him going to Nob. Providentially, it almost brought to an end the house of Eli. It was a trial for him because he was going to break the law, as Christ tells us. And it was David's spirit that made it acceptable, that he had no leprosy like one who would come after him. And yet it was an opportunity too, to see that cherubim embroidered upon the wall. Well, next he goes from there into Philistine lands. He goes all the way to Gath. That was no accident. It wasn't just on the way to somewhere. That was for a purpose, and we're not going to look at why that was in this talk, but that's coming up. Because indeed he had an opportunity in Gath for sanctuary, and he had an opportunity for preaching, and that preaching was to work miracles later on. But it was a trial too, because David was going to a foreign land, leaving the ecclesia behind. He was going to a way of death, as it were, mixing with the friends of the world. And it wasn't a good thing to do. And at that time, God decided for David that he must not go there and he must move on. And David was tried at that time. And we know that when he was before those walls of Gath, that he immediately pens Psalm 56. And we'll go to that psalm. Psalm 34 is also a psalm of this time, but recorded after his delivery, his reflections on that delivery. But Psalm 56 is the psalm of this time. And we read there in verse 8. Just picking out the one verse, he says, "Thou tellest my wanderings, put thou my tears into thy bottle. Are they not in thy book?" So here is David saying, well, look, I went to Nob and now I've gone to Gath. And at Gath, this is what happened to me. And God was with me. God was watching me. And Rotherham describes this verse in this way. "My wanderings hast thou recorded. Put thou my tears in thy bottle. Are they not in thy record?" And the RSV says, "Thou hast kept count of my tossings. Put thou my tears in thy bottle. Are they not in thy book?" The same applies to us. The trials and tribulations of family and ecclesial life are watched by God, are recorded by God. Our sadness, our hurt, our despair, God makes record of that, as it were, against that day of judgment to come. And David said in Psalm 34 that the angel of Yahweh was encamping around him and all those that fear him and delivering them. David understood that all these trials were in God's purpose. Can we understand the same? He next goes to the cave of Adullam, and there he's joined by many who are troubled within the ecclesia. And during trials, we have to make many decisions. And those decisions may be wrong, but the consequences might teach us many things. And those decisions might be right, and we might be able to move on to the next trial after that. And one of the hard choices for David that came next was that his mum and dad came to support him. And of course, they were no longer safe in Bethlehem. Where should he take them? Should he drag his aged parents, especially his father, around with him on that wandering that we saw in that map on our first day? Well, he chooses to go to Moab, to a place called Mizpah, the watchtower of Moab. Do you remember Ruth's day, when Elimelech looked out from Bethlehem, where they had drought, and could see across the Jordan Valley to the hills of Moab, perhaps to Mizpah itself, from a good vantage point? And everything seemed rosy on the other side. The grass looked much greener there. And so off he went. Well, David goes across there to take his parents. And he's told, "You've got to stay in Judah, David. It's in the ecclesia that these trials are to come upon you. You better come back." Let's look at 1 Samuel 22 as we continue in the record. 1 Samuel 22 and verse 5. And the prophet Gad said unto David, Abide not in the hole, depart, and get thee into the land of Judah. Then David departed and came into the forest of Harith. And so David has to stay in Judah. Don't leave Judah, says God. You stay there. That's where I want some trials to come upon you. And so he goes there. He goes to the forest of Harith. That word forest means a thicket. And Harith means a wood. He went to the densest, thickest part of the woods that he could find in Judah. And immediately Saul gets message, oh, David's here. There was to be nowhere safe for David. And likewise, we can't just run away and think, well, we'll be safe. No more trial will come upon us, because it will. And so the next trial is in the heart of Judah. And it's against the national enemy, the Philistines, because he has to go and rescue the city of Keilah. And come back, if you would, just into Judges 13. We have some links into the Judges this morning and tomorrow also. And Judges 13, of course, we've had the background this morning through our brother Jim. And we read here in verse 5 that, Lo, thou shalt conceive and bear a son, and no razor shall come on his head, for the child shall be a Nazarite unto God from the womb, and he shall begin to deliver Israel out of the hand of the Philistines. Samson's work was a work of beginning. And our brother Jim took us back into Exodus, where it would be little by little. Well, that work ended with David. In fact, we find with David that many of the national enemies of Israel that Abraham first comes into contact with, including the Jebusite, the Amalekite, and the Philistine, David typically destroys them. There's no war, in fact, with the Philistines after David has destroyed them for some 300 years until Hezekiah's day. And David, as it were, is typifying for us the Lord Jesus Christ in that period between his return and the establishment of the kingdom, where the type is handed over to Solomon. And so Samson began to fight the Philistines. And 2 Samuel 19 and verse 9, the people rejoiced because David had delivered them from their enemies and from the hand of the Philistines. And he's got to go, 1 Samuel 23, to a city called Keilah, which means a stronghold or a defense, which has but one entrance and exit, the front door. And David says, well, do I really have to go there? You know, brethren and sisters, there may be trouble for another brother or sister, but if we're having trouble ourselves, well, I'm sorry, that's not my problem. I'm a bit busy at the moment. And maybe if my problem's solved and they're still having difficulty, I can help them out. Not so. God says to David, look, helping them is part of your development. Helping them is part of your trial. And so 1 Samuel 23 and verse 2, David inquired of Yahweh, saying, Shall I go and smite these Philistines? And Yahweh said unto David, Go and smite the Philistines, save Keilah. Verse 3 tells us that the men want to be out of Judah. They don't want to get involved with Philistines. They've got enough on their head with Saul. They know that Saul will come upon them. And so we find in verse 4 that David inquired of Yahweh yet again. And Yahweh answered him and said, Arise and go down to Keilah, for I will deliver the Philistines into thy hand. We haven't got the time to develop the links between David and Gideon. But Gideon, likewise with the fleece, prayed twice for reassurance. Gideon, of course, It was in his day that we find these dens and caves and strongholds being built. Gideon says, my family are poor. He says, I'm the least in my family. And of course, echoes are in the life of David. And Gideon, of course, went down into the Midianite camp and he took just one servant with him. And David goes into Saul's camp and takes just one servant with him. David stands on the edge of the camp and shouts out to Saul. And Gideon was on the edge of the camp of the Midianites, crying out, and there is a great deliverance from both. And so we find that there are many links that we could go into. And yet it's amazing, isn't it? If you're still in 1 Samuel 23, look in at verse 7, that it was told Saul that David was come to Keilah. And Saul said, God hath delivered him into mine hand, for he is shut in, by entering into a town that hath gates and bars. And Saul called all the people together to war, to go down to Keilah, to besiege David and his men. God says to David, I'll deliver you from Keilah. You will go down there, they'll give you up to Saul, but I'll deliver you. Here is an opportunity for you, David, to help your brothers and sisters. And on the very opposite end, you've got Saul saying, well, God's given me an opportunity to kill David, to kill my enemy. And it's amazing that there are occasions in life where brethren will, on the one hand, believe that this opportunity is for them to act in a certain direction. And other brethren will genuinely believe that this is an opportunity for them to act in the complete opposite way. And both will be genuine in their actions. And yet probably most likely just one is right and one is wrong. And yet Saul continually believed that each opportunity was given him from God. But David knew and understood that it was an opportunity given him from God. And so we find that David is delivered. Verse 13. David and his men, which were about 600, arose and departed out of Keilah and went whithersoever they could. And it was told Saul that David was escaped from Keilah, and he forbear to go forth. And keeping a marker here, if you come back to the psalm of this occasion, Psalm 31. And just picking out a verse or two here. Here is David's thoughts at this time. Psalm 31 and verse 8. He says that God hath not shut me up into the hand of the enemy. Thou hast set my feet in a large room. Keilah represented a prison, and yet he was able to be released from it. Verse 21. Blessed be Yahweh, for he hath showed me his marvelous kindness in a strong city, fenced city, says the margin. This is Keilah. For I said in my haste, I am cut off from before thine eyes. Nevertheless, thou heardest the voice of my supplication when I cried unto thee. There's the prayer of David. O Yahweh, O love Yahweh, all ye his saints, for Yahweh preserveth the faithful and plentifully rewardeth the proud doer. Be of good courage, and he shall strengthen your heart, all ye that hope in Yahweh. And there is David's mind. Well, back in 1 Samuel and chapter 23 and verse 15, he now immediately goes to a place called Ziph in a wood, and it's in a wilderness. And once again, he's going to this place to hide away. And immediately the Ziphites tell on him. Ziphites, we believe, were related to Nabal. And here he is, trying to hide from trouble, trying to do the right thing, keep his head down, but no opportunity to, because there are brethren who feel that they can get advancement by telling on David. They feel that they'll be in Saul's favour if they can do this thing. And so we read in verse 19 that the Ziphites came to Saul to Gibeah, saying, "Doth not David hide himself with us in strongholds in the wood in the hill of Hakilah, which is on the south of Jeshimon?" And once again, if we just keep a hand here and turn to Psalm 54, we find David's mind as he's betrayed by his own brethren, by those who were related through the family of Judah. Psalm 54 and verse 4. "Behold, God is mine helper. Yahweh is with them that uphold my soul. He shall reward evil unto mine enemies. Cut them off in thy truth. I will freely sacrifice unto thee. I will praise thy name, O Yahweh, for it is good. For he hath delivered me out of all trouble, and mine eyes have seen his desire upon mine enemies." And so there is David rejoicing in his deliverance in this psalm. And back in 1 Samuel and chapter 23, what was Saul's attitude when the Ziphites come to him? Verse 21 of 1 Samuel 23, that Saul said, "Blessed be ye Ziphites of Yahweh, for you've had compassion on me." Oh, poor Saul. He's distressed. He can't destroy this brother. No matter what he does, this brother seems to prosper. And he says to his servants, "Doesn't anyone feel sorry for me?" And along come the Ziphites, and he says, "Ah, you've had compassion on me." Such is the attitude of those who misunderstand what compassion we can give to the sheep within the ecclesia. And so David then goes to Maon, and what results here is a dramatic scene for David and for Saul too. And it is a dramatic scene because it teaches us a very salient lesson concerning trial. 1 Samuel 23 and verse 25. "Saul also and his men went to seek David, and they told David, whereof he came down into a rock and abode in the wilderness of Maon. And when Saul heard that, he pursued after David into the wilderness of Maon. And Saul went on this side of the mountain, and David and his men on that side of the mountain. And David made haste to get away for fear of Saul. For Saul and his men compassed David and his men round about to take them. But there came a messenger unto Saul, saying, 'Haste thee, come, for the Philistines have invaded the land.' Wherefore Saul returned from pursuing after David and went against the Philistines. Therefore they called that place Selah Hamalekoth. And David went up from thence and dwelt in strongholds at En-Gedi." That's the narrative, brethren and sisters. Let's see what the words mean. It says there that he was compassed about. Verse 26, "Saul and his men compassed David and his men round about." And that word compass means as a crown. A crown, of course, is circular. David is surrounded, and there we can see the other occurrences of that word compassed. And it's translated as the word crown on all these other occasions. Saul had crowned David, but it wasn't to be king. It was to kill him. And what does David say? Or what does David do? In verse 26, in the middle of the verse, it says that David made haste to get away. Just keep your hand here and quickly come to Psalm 31. That psalm that we've just looked at concerning Keilah. And here is this word, Psalm 31 and verse 22. "For I said in my haste, I am cut off from before thine eyes. Nevertheless, thou heardest the voice of my supplications when I cried unto thee." The word haste means, Jesenius says, to spring up suddenly in order to flee. David was caught off guard. Now, David was in the hill, or the rock, we're told, which was a mountain, in this area here in Judah. Now, David is on this hill, and he's got a good vantage point, so he should see Saul coming. But David is caught unawares, and Saul is going to crown him. And it's said that Saul went on this side of the mountain, and in fact, he went right around that mountain. And David had a small window of opportunity to escape. So David and his men jump up and they rush down. And Saul's going to get him. There's no escape. There's no way out. He's going to die. And you know, brothers and sisters, when Jeremiah pleaded to God that he should be delivered from the trial and tribulation he was facing, God said to him, "Don't worry, Jeremiah. You will be delivered. I'm going to make you a brazen wall," said God to Jeremiah. "And they're going to beat on that wall, Jeremiah. And they're going to bash against you, Jeremiah. But I'll deliver you in the end." That's not really very reassuring, is it? And you know, David has no escape. God, if he's going to save David, must miraculously deliver him. And a messenger comes to Saul. And we read it there in this record here in verse 27. "There came a messenger unto Saul, saying, Haste thee and come, for the Philistines have invaded the land." Do you see what the margin said? The Philistines are like locusts. There's another link back to Gideon. And Saul has no choice. It's either destroy one man or lose the whole nation. And that links forward to the high priest, does it not, in Jesus' day? What a scene of escape. And you know, brothers and sisters, we can expect no different. If we have a trial or a tribulation that is hard to bear, then we will find deliverance, but it may be at the very last moment. We may be at the end of our tether. Our depression may get so bad for us, but God will be there. And there will be that messenger. There will be that way to relieve us from that trial. And David learnt from this trial. There was seemingly no way out. But he continued on a path that seemed best. He expected the very worst. And God, in his mercy, provided a way of escape. And a removal of the issue, the threat, the problem, whatever it might be. And you know, it says here that David named that place Selah Hamelikoth. And that's made up of three words: rock, a word that means dividing, and a word that means giving or portions. And we have no time to look at it, but the word rock is the word Selah. It's a word that it's not the word for rock as in the name of God, one of the titles of God, Zur, the hard rock that we find first mentioned in the Exodus record when Moses had to strike the rock. But this word Selah is first used when Moses had to speak to the rock. Christ in immortality rather than mortality. And the word portions or giving is a word that was used by David when he divided the courses of the Levites, the Aaronites, the porters. And the other word is used of the dividing of the land. And look what we've put at the end here. It was the subdivision by Joshua, Yah shall save, when Eleazar was with him, Ael is my help. They're in front of the tabernacle and they're in Shiloh, which means a place of rest. That's where David's mind went to when he named this rock. But just think for a moment, brothers and sisters. And we have to be quick. We've been in the life of Samson this morning. Samson had a wife. He was engaged to this girl from Timnah. And he went together. And her father had given her to someone else, his best man. And her father says, "We'll have a younger sister instead." starting to think of David yet? He was offered a wife, Merab. Her father gave her to someone else, offered a younger sister instead. And then we find that Samson achieved a great victory against the Philistines, just as David did, as recorded in 1 Samuel 18 and 19. But then Samson goes into the land of Judah. That's interesting, isn't it? He wasn't in the area of Dan where he should have been. And he comes to a rock, we're told. And the inhabitants of Judah betray him. Any more similarities? And God provides a great deliverance. Samson destroys the 300 of the 3,000 Philistines with the jawbone of the ass. And Samson names that rock, twice in fact. And here's David at the rock in Judah in exactly the same circumstances. Do you know what this is telling us, brothers and sisters? It's telling us that David went there on purpose because he thought about a scriptural example. Where was someone in a similar circumstance? Where can I look back in the scriptures of truth? And he looked back to the life of Samson. And so we can expect such trials to come upon us. Just turn to Luke in chapter 6. Luke 6 and verse 22. Blessed are ye when men shall hate you, and when they shall separate you from their company, and shall reproach you and cast out your name as evil. This is David in front of Saul, isn't it? Verse 23, rejoice ye in that day, leap for joy, for behold, your reward is great in heaven. For in the like manner did their fathers unto the prophets, unto David, we could read there. And verse 26, woe unto you when men shall speak well of you, for so did their fathers to the false prophets. But he says, you've got to love your enemies, do good to them that hate you, bless them that curse you and despitefully use you. And so we find that this chapter goes on to speak about those trials. David had suffered so much, and if we have not highlighted one of the occasions that you like in the life of David, then apologies. There are so many in this fugitive time, and we're going to pick up on one or two more tomorrow. But how can we draw our thoughts into a summary? Well, we've seen the tribulation of David at the hands of Saul, at the hands of his servants, at the hands of the men of Judah, the whole ecclesia, men who wished for gain and advancement. We've seen the contrast between such actions and true faithfulness. The wise warn that a talebearer revealeth secrets, but he that is of a faithful spirit concealeth the matter. And where no wood is, the fire goeth out. So where there is no talebearer, the strife ceaseth. We know that these trials amongst brothers and sisters will come, presenting to us opportunities to do good to others and to learn from trial, opportunities for action that might have different consequences, unplanned and perhaps unwanted. Such trials as David was forced to face later in life, when he was presented with three options following the numbering of Israel, and none of those were pleasant at all, will come upon us. And we must all be tried, and so we will live to see troubled time. And it's not for us to decide if such time should come. But what we have to decide is what to do with the time that is given us and how to respond when such troubles come. We've been assured that the righteous shall never be moved, but the wicked shall not inhabit the earth. Let us therefore be strong in the grace given to us, and let not your heart envy sinners, but continue in the fear of Yahweh all the day. Surely there is a future, and your hope will not be cut off. Proverbs 23.